Welcome to the A-News Podcast. This is episode 80 for September 7th, 2018. This podcast covers anarchist activity, ideas, and conversations from the previous week. It's designed to be useful to anarchists and the anarcho-curious. Give us feedback and constructive criticism at our email address, podcast@anarchistnews.org. For more information and usually good commentary, go to the nonsectarian anarchistnews.org.
A short editorial by Dim. When I was small, I would watch the young men parade the portable shrine through the streets at the local shrine festival. They were intoxicated with their task, and their expressions were of an indescribable abandon, their faces averted. Some of them even rested the backs of their necks against the shafts of the shrine they shouldered, so that their eyes gazed up at the heavens, and my mind was much troubled by the riddle of what it was that those eyes reflected. As to the nature of the intoxicating vision that I detected in all this violent physical stress, my imagination provided no clue. For many a month, therefore, the enigma continued to occupy my mind. It was only much later, after I had begun to learn the language of the flesh, that I undertook to help in shouldering a portable shrine, and was at last able to solve the puzzle that had plagued me since infancy. They were simply looking at the sky. In their eyes, there was no vision. Only the reflection of the blue and absolute skies of early autumn. Those blue skies, though, were unusual skies, such as I might never see again in my life. One moment strung up high aloft, the next plunged to the depths. Constantly shifting, a strange compound of lucidity and madness. Yukio Mishima. Dear Diary, recently I had the synchronicity of beginning training in Muay Thai and coming across this passage in Mishima's Sun and Steel, a coincidence that suddenly threw new and great meaning behind the physicality of my training. Suddenly, it wasn't just a break in the monotony of a desk-ridden job life, or a bashing away at the resentment that this job pushes just under my skin, but instead, I was pushing myself beyond intellectual perception, grinding down the divide between body and mind through painful, brute repetition, a ritual practice to push myself further into the life stream beyond the taxonomic divisions of human-animal, animate-inanimate, conscious, unconscious, further into the background noise that is beyond life. That is life! And then, I actually started doing Muay Thai, and discovered quickly that even if Thai fighters are in fact lithe, oiled, mystico-animist warriors, I, struggling to accomplish even the most fundamental moves, would be murdered by one of them, aged about 8 years old. I was crushed by this realization, pushed once again down what I've discovered as an exceedingly familiar ritual formation in my life, as false as any formation is. This ritual consists of accidental discovery, overenthusiasm, failure, and begrudging perseverance. As with Muay Thai, so goes my path into anarchy, anarchism, whatever. I stumbled into it at random, getting way too excited with a hope of filling some vaguely spiritual-ish kind of need in myself, hoping that through its rituals I could help people, which I failed at, and then hoping I could at least help myself, failing again, and coming to a crushing recognition of this failure. In both of these cases, I landed in a hazy, ritual space of obligated perseverance. For Muay Thai, it's a financial obligation, because for ritual these days, you gotta pay. And for anarchism, it's different. It's the presence of some kind friends, a certain trouble and anxiety with this world, a type of curiosity, and an opportunity to fail in new ways, spaces, etc. Thanks for listening. Some mold called Dim.
What's new this week? Report on the 5th Black Rose / Rosa Negra National Convention, Los Angeles. From It's Going Down by Alex Issa and Tanya T.N., Aguebana, and Adam Weaver. This is an extended report back with many links, photos, videos, attached readings, and multiple authors. Because the next best thing to being at a boring, long-winded, power-hungry conference is yearning to, from afar. Quote, far from being observers, our international comrades also contributed to a discussion and proposal to establish the creation of an America's Coordinator, which would act as a coordinating body for similar revolutionary groups with Northern and Southern America. The defined purpose would be, quote, to formalize political relationships with organizations across the Americas that share similar political programs, social insertion work, analysis, and outlook. Concretely, the purpose would be to organize exchanges among militants, develop shared political analysis, and perhaps even stimulate the formation of new political organizations. Convention delegates overwhelmingly expressed their support for this project before hearing more from a panel of the international attendees on their local struggles. During the convention, members of BRRN recorded messages of support for ongoing struggles against the criminalization of abortion in Argentina and Chile as an expression of solidarity, unquote. Anyone else getting shivers? No?
Anarchist Zines and Pamphlets, August 2018, from SproutDistro.com. On Repression Patterns in Europe from European Anarchist Black Cross Groups, Rebellion and Possibility by the Radical Education Department on Anti-ICE Actions, and Anarchist Primer from a text off of IGD, it doesn't, quote, really engage with the ins and outs of what anarchy is, unquote, lol, occupation, revolt, power on the first month of the ICE occupation in Philly. Beyond the sad comforts and stale air of radicalism, some excerpts from the book Joyful Militancy, notes on militant folds from the folks who do the Hostage Journal. This article and the anti-Tikkun piece that it responds to are included in another pamphlet, hashtag younggirl, that is available on Little Black Cart.
A century since the Bolshevik crackdown of August 1918, from CrimeThink. This is some of the history of communists killing and brutalizing anarchists. The piece, and the responses to it on ANews, demonstrate adequately the problems of focusing on history, which is that it's too easy to get lost in the weeds. Although, I guess it's fair to say that I wander around in weeds plenty, they're just a different genus. Anyway, if history is your shtick and you can avoid a knee-jerk Einziger reaction, this thread could be fun for you.
Anti-Fascism and the Left's Euro-Secular Arrogance, from Gods and Radicals by Reed Wildermuth. I like Reed's writing. What I have read of his consistently troubles things that I think need troubling, and this essay is no different. While I might quibble that the experience he talks about here, the knee-jerk reactions to a kind of spiritual practice, has become so common that the example seems out of date, it is nonetheless undeniable that he is talking about fascistic behavior in the name of anti-fascism, and that is a message that needs to be heard over and over again these days. Quote, while a case can be made that pagan, esoteric, and occult forms are fascist and do not belong in leftist or anarchist movements, the exact case can also be made that they were important parts of leftist and anarchist movements from the very beginning. Thus, leftists who label pagan beliefs as fascist by pointing to historical connections are only ever looking at half of the evidence, if they are even looking at all. Why they would appear to miss that evidence has been addressed succinctly by post-colonial historian Deepesh Chakrabarty in his work Provincializing Europe. Basically, European secularism is an artificial narrative, and it is one that attempts to override its own non-secularism, erasing traces of folk traditions and religious beliefs within European, and generally Western, societies, helps European societies and intellectuals see themselves as more advanced and modern than the rest of the world. That is, this secular atheism is a product of its own colonial arrogance, unquote. There's also a sound response to his thesis in the comments, challenging the essentialism Reed himself falls into, from Anon, of course.
War on the War, Fire for DGAP, German Society for Foreign Politics, from 325, an extended communique. Quote, with this, we take responsibility for the incendiary device we placed in front of the building of the German Society for Foreign Politics, DGAP, in Druckbauchstrasse, Tiergarten, on the night of August 21st, 2018. War starts here, in the halls of politics. War starts everywhere, where people throw away their empathy to profit from the globalized misery. In the war industry, the think tanks of science, in the faceless administration of bureaucracy, in the form of uniformed slaves who receive and obey orders in rank and file. War starts between human beings when concurrence and aspiration to power reigns over solidarity and the free development of the individual. Unquote.
The Mythology of Work, from CrimeThink. This is from CrimeThink's book called Work, and it's a fine primer on the topic for those who can't dirty their hands with a Bob Black book or any of the other people who have theorized against work. Quote, selling our time rather than doing things for their own sake, we come to evaluate our lives on the basis of how much we can get in exchange for them, not what we get out of them. As freelance slaves hawking our lives hour by hour, we think of ourselves as each having a price. The amount of the price becomes our measure of value. In that sense, we become commodities, just like toothpaste and toilet paper. What once was a human being is now an employee. in the same way that what once was a pig is now a pork chop. Our lives disappear, spent like the money for which we trade them. Unquote.
Scott Crowe versus Tucker Carlson on Fox. From scottcrowe.org. This is a clip of Scott Crowe responding to provocations by Tucker Carlson and participating in the faux gladiator show that is now the news. Broadcasters invite people on and hope that the resulting fireworks will spark some interest in viewers. Scott may feel like he is speaking truth to power, but the context renders any accuracy absolutely moot. The comments are mostly off-topic and prove yet again that Sir Einzica has way too much free time, as do Anons, of course.
Shane, an undercover cop in Hamilton, Ontario, from North Shore Counter Info. This Canadian story comes with a picture of someone outed as an undercover cop. It is absolutely worth reading and is an example of what should be happening more often, i.e. recounting people's experiences of informants and undercover cops, whether they are successful or not. Quote, Shane was just another dude when he showed up. To be honest, most of us didn't take notice, at least not at first. There were no leading or intrusive questions. He didn't incite divisive arguments or spread gossip. He was quiet, maybe even boring. And while he did persistently harass some women in our community to grab a beer, despite rejection, it didn't scream, "Cop!" so much as misogyny. An experience that's unfortunately still somewhat normal in our circles. To those who engaged or paid attention, Shane presented himself as a bicycle-riding part-time painter, complete with a shitty supercycle bike and painting pants. He had an apartment at 20 Emerald Street North, a Hamilton housing building for folks with low income, that was furnished with a leather couch, some photos, and some paintings. Shane had a girlfriend who worked at a private daycare, who no one met, and a muscular feminine-presenting friend with below-shoulder-length brown hair from Dundas, who came to at least one event, unquote. Even with all the issues regarding false stories that will happen about specific individuals, as the state will always turn our carefulness against us, it's still important to learn how these informants operate.
Abstentionist posters and anarcho-syndicalist perspectives on elections, from Montreal Counter Info. This is an anti-voting piece from some syndicalists in Canada. Quote, for us, so-called leftist parties place social movements and well-intentioned activists' energy in an electoralist dead end that offers only disappointment, treason, instrumentalization, manipulation, lies, illusions, etc. While the electoral machine of the so-called leftist parties are being built, minds and thoughts of social movement activists are pushed towards statist alienation and electoral wait-and-see attitudes. If there is no capitalism with a human face, and if the state is the wheel of our exploitation, then we'll have to abolish both to be free. Unquote.
Action in solidarity with the political prisoners of Eluxo Chitlan de Flores Magón, from Act for Freedom Now. A communique on an action as part of the Week of Solidarity with Anarchist Prisoners. Quote, on August 30th, 2018, a group of comrades took to the streets in front of the transition house of the president-elect of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador. There, they briefly blocked traffic and showered the police, media, and bystanders with flyers denouncing the judicial corruption and state repression being carried out against community members of Eluxo Chitlan de Flores Magón, Huaca. The banner blocking the highway read, Freedom to the prisoners of Eluxo Chitlan de Flores Magón, Week of Solidarity with Anarchist Prisoners, unquote.
Melbourne's trade hall targeted by man who planned to carry out terrorist attacks, from ABC. This is a mainstream media story from Australia about a man who was arrested because he, quote, planned to carry out terrorist attacks on three Melbourne targets intended to recruit people by handing out information on how to make explosive devices, unquote. Quote, on the first day of Mr. Galea's committal hearing, prosecutor David Stolle alleged there was electronic material showing Mr. Galea was targeting the Melbourne Anarchist Club in Northcote, the Resistance Center in the CBD, and Trades Hall in Carlton, where Mr. Galea collected intelligence and conducted reconnaissance. Mr. Stolle said Mr. Galea wanted to produce what he called the Patriots Cookbook, which would show how to make smoke bombs and metal bombs by using potassium nitrate, for the advancement of extreme right-wing ideology to overcome the perceived Islamicization of Australia, unquote.
The False Idol of Self-Sacrifice, from the most recent issue of Anathema. This is a short piece on something that deserves a lot more space, but it's a start. It addresses the issue of what is acceptable participation in the society we want to destroy, which for many involves doing social work. Quote, there's a whole network of activists whose anarchism is simply to do the social work neglected by the state. A strategy that not only seems to go unquestioned within such circles, but rather is continually applauded as though it were the most honorable form of struggle. These figurative social workers usually have aims beyond those of the state, but tend only to seek out a new authority to submit to and be punished by. This is notable in how social justice or accountability frameworks often tend to uphold rather than challenge existent social norms. This tendency toward authority, of course, necessitates a larger populace to submit, to struggle, and to sacrifice. This is a leftist tendency, to softly martyr oneself for the cause, clinging to the identities authority has forced upon us as some sort of empowerment. This is a leftist tendency, to softly martyr oneself for the cause, clinging to the identities authority has forced upon us as some sort of empowerment, while in reality attempting to build on narratives of weakness. It involves promoting the most marginalized to leadership positions in order to reverse the current hierarchy, while simultaneously creating a new hierarchy based on the same identitarian logic. Unquote.
An Anarchism of the Working Class, from the Institute for Anarchist Studies by Miriam Pickens. This is a thoughtful reflection on a pamphlet called Wither Anarchism, Three Essays by Christian Williams. Pickens is thoughtful and considered and reps a very different anarchy than the one I recognize. Quote, Williams recognizes that his vision of a new society is related to how the new society is to be brought about. How can it be defended and sustain itself? How are disputes to be settled? How do we prevent new tyrannies from arising? End quote. I think we have to say that we don't have answers to these questions, and I agree with Williams that, quote, to translate our ideals into reality requires a strategy. It will not be enough to rely on our ethical sense and our desire for freedom, unquote. The need for a strategy to prevent the reemergence of capitalism is precisely why a revolutionary anarchist organization is necessary, to set out from the beginning our commitment to going all the way to defeat capitalism. We must have confidence that in the course of struggle, people will learn and develop skills that will enable them to define a new way of living that promotes a new culture. Unquote. Pickens is an old woman who has come to anarchism late in life after many years of political activity. It could be fun to disagree with her in person, but maybe we'd just end up hitting each other with our walkers.
Under the Radar, Review of a People's History of Civilization from Artillery Magazine by Doug Harvey. This is a report that was sent to us by Zerzan himself on Jay-Z's newest book. The report praises Jay-Z and the book. Quote, despite discursive roots extending back to Henry David Thoreau's proto-ecologism, or even Rousseau's noble savage, anarcho-primitivism is subject to the same tsunami of programmatic institutional contempt that faces any philosophical postulate that doesn't have the preservation of tenure as an inviolable, if unspoken, core tenet. Call it the shut-up-stupid-hippie defense, yet some of the most intellectually brilliant non-academic literary-slash-philosophical statements of our time, from Ursula Le Guin's translation of the Tao Te Ching to Gary Snyder's The Practice of the Wild to Feral House author Theodore Kaczynski's Industrial Society and Its Future, are anarcho-primitivist classics, and considerably more persuasive and coherent than anything that has emerged from the academy since at least the early 1970s, unquote. The report is light on any comparisons to other green anarchist texts, not even Kevin Tucker gets a mention, or ideas, but it's an endearingly personal little piece about how finding a writer at the right time in our lives can mean a lot to us.
Call out for international solidarity from the Hambacher Forest, from Contra Info, a call for help from the occupying anarchists, quote, right now, a large-scale police action in the Hambach Forest occupation is taking place. The protest camp fighting against energy company RWE's destruction of land and climate must be sustained until the last tree is standing. The eviction of the occupation is coming ever closer, and the struggle is becoming clearer every day. Climate change does not stop at the borders, and neither does our movement. Therefore, we are calling for actions of solidarity to take place all over Germany, all over Europe, and all over the world, unquote.
New anarchist publication, Entanglement, on Anarchism and Individualism, from north-short.info. Quote, from the introduction, what you hold in your hands is an experiment in collective analysis and writing. It is also a critical engagement with the place individualism does hold and or should hold in anarchism. Initially, one person asked some friends to come together and co-create a collection of texts against individualism. Whether the project is actually against individualism is still up for debate. We've done a lot of playing with language, and some of us prefer on individualism, or critically engaging with individualism. In reality, it is all of those things, and also other things too. Defenses of duty and futurity, critiques of some old philosophers, calls to reconsider oppression and social position, some explorations of the interdependence of all forms of life, and thoughts on our wider interstellar context, unquote. This will be a provocative read for some of us. I'm looking forward to it.
North Shore counter info at 6 months. Trends so far and call for submissions. From North Shore counter-info. This is a check-in from this website in which they discuss their first year so far, upcoming plans, and goals. Quote, another option if you don't like writing a whole essay is to make use of comments on North Shore. Unlike some other counter-info websites, we feel that making it easy to respond to articles with a different perspective or for their context is crucial. Commenting on North Shore is anonymous and comments are moderated before posting, so although that causes a delay, it also eliminates the fuck you commie fags, comments, and spam, although we are saving our favorite high-quality hate mail for our scrapbooks. Finding ways to expand discussion on the site and to encourage event submission is a goal of ours for challenging reliance on social media. At the very least, we would like it to be possible for people to engage with movements locally without having to use these commercial platforms which compromise our security and produce the most alienated forms of relating to one another. Submitting events and moving discussion here are great ways to contribute to building up North Shore as a grassroots communications infrastructure project. Ultimately, we are just a website and want to strongly encourage anarchists and anti-authoritarians to prioritize building and maintaining face-to-face relationships and networks, which cannot be replaced on the internet other than in impoverished forms, unquote.
Audio, the Brilliant Podcast, episode 78, Layla Abdel-Rahim, about an hour. This is Aragorn playing softball. It's understandable since English is not Layla's first language, among other reasons, so if you're interested in hearing Aragorn in a different mode, this episode is for you.
Anarchy Radio, September 4th, 2018, an hour. The ANU's comments on this thread are better than usual, including some suggestions that could really help Anarchy Radio as a project.
The Hotwire number 34, August 29th, 2018, 37 minutes. Fascist activity, anti-Pope activity, anti-fascist activity, anti-ICE activity, anti-statue activity, John Brown gun club activity, prison strike information and actions, which is getting attention from people, including prisoners around the world, and a brief talk from someone out of Tacoma, Washington, doing support work against the detention center there. This episode adds morning radio show-style sound effects and interesting tonal decision. Also curious was the praise of someone's stoicism after getting punched in the face in an oddly macho tone. Michael Lodenthal talks about riotization, which might get the award for hardest-to-pronounce newly coined word.
Fuck the Bins, episode 2, August 30, 2018. 18 minutes, from the London Anarchist Federation. This episode of this new podcast includes a book report on a history of the world in Seven Cheap Things by Patel and Moore, comments on camera surveillance, books that inspired us, Existentialism is Humanism by Jean-Paul Sartre, anti-fascist and international news, an anarchist library in Zurich, the 12th Balkan Anarchist Book Fair, and London events. A lot to fit in to roughly 18 minutes. Multiple voices, none of them interact with each other. So far, an addition that is welcome, if a bit dry, to anarchist podcasts.
The Hotwire number 35, September 5th, 2018. 43 minutes. Prison strike, murder of a sex worker, prayers against prisons, widespread teacher strikes, white supremacy updates, anti-deportation actions, a report back on the fight against the pipeline. Maybe the show needs an embarrassment of the episode segment. For this episode, I'd elect the cringeworthy PC-er than... For this episode, I'd elect the cringeworthy PC-er than thou back and forth about a murdered woman's father's reference to liking Latinx food that is in the middle of his defense of immigrants. Some people lose their minds in the effort to ally.
Topic of the week is I'm in labor. It is Labor Day 2018. Labor Day in the United States is a public holiday celebrated on the first Monday in September in honors of the American labor movement and the contributions that workers have made to the strength, prosperity, laws, and well-being of this country. Let those words sink in for a moment. Like, today, in neighborhoods across the country, everyone but the labor force will have the day off. The smell of cheap meat will blanket the gentrified neighborhoods that look like someone got a degree in copy and paste. In the book titled The Organization Man, published in 1956, we're introduced to a labor attitude that is completely dissolved today, right? We see a person who lets their individuality and personal life become dominated by the organization they work for. In it, we find the roots of the myth that a janitor can one day become the CEO. During the Great Railroad Strike of 1877, approximately 100 union members were murdered while standing up against militias, police, and soldiers. This is hardly the only example of the labor movement putting the lives of its members on the line. Today, you're not going to see any union members negotiating with their lives, though, right? And it seems unlikely that that's ever going to happen again. I apologize to the propagandists still shouting that we should seize the means of production for what I'm about to say, because I fear I'm probably threatening their job. But without stable living conditions or job security, community organizing is a forgotten dream. If we are cold and hungry, the foundation of long-term relationship building in a single town will fade from memory as we are forced to move from place to place. Thus, trust built face-to-face is becoming an increasingly rare commodity. Would the threat of losing your job or house be too much to face? What if you were forced to skip town and rebuild your relationships, like the organization man, from the ground up? Is a solitary labor of love enough, or will you need something or someone more?
That's an interesting sort of dark turn in that topic of the week, because on the one hand, of course, we can just talk about Labor Day being fake May Day and all that sort of thing. And that's obviously one version of this conversation. But I'm actually going to talk about the thing that came to me while you were reading this, which, you know, many of us, and I'll say this sort of as a post-left anarchist, I strongly believe that once the agitational working class, once the working class was destroyed as enough of a thing, once the labor movement was destroyed, the possibility of social change, in my estimation, was eliminated. And I mean social change in the sense that we mean when we talk about revolution. Obviously, bills and laws are still being agitated for and whatnot. But the kind of deep change that most anarchists are talking about when we talk about the kind of change we want, without there being a meaningful counterforce against the forces of capitalism and the state, in my opinion, without the labor movement. So that's referred to in this little rant. As like, without that, we're done. But I actually want to go one abstraction deeper. In my opinion, the meaningful crime that I feel like anarchists are uniquely qualified to point at isn't the end of the labor movement. It's the idea of rent. In other words, if we stop paying rent, a lot of these freedoms that are implied that are gone now that there's no labor movement to fight for them, if we stop paying rent, we would actually have an awful lot of our freedom back. So really, the labor movement is an abstraction that is built ostensibly in a sort of positive affirmation sort of way. But the idea of land ownership and of maintaining that relationship that you should have to the land that you're walking on, that is almost like a more positive sort of project that we could do. Like, now, the problem is that most leftists will immediately turn this into a conversation about rent strikes. But for me, the point isn't a rent strike. For me, the point is the idea of charging rent in the first place. Now, obviously, that we then come into a conversation about people who are less than fully household, homeless people, you know, or houseless people. And this conversation becomes a very different sort of one about, who is motivated to start that fight? Where does that fight begin? And then what does the initial counter sort of revolution look like?
I mean, and that almost jumps back. You and I were having a conversation the other day, right, about People's Park in Berkeley, where mm-hmm. Where you have a large homeless population that is at this point allowed to be there sometimes, and what the demographics around that homeless population and how homeless to, or I don't know what the proper nomenclature is, but how homeless some of them are and mm-hmm. things around that. And yeah, who is prepared to start that, right? So these labor strikes of 100 years ago where perhaps a person with a family actually had the most motivation to die on the front lines, right? Now that person may feel like that level of agitation would actually put them at way more risk than someone with a little less to lose.
Yeah, certainly, you know, trying to care for a family while homeless or unhoused is quite the prospect.
But when we talk about the homeless population, what percentage of the entire population are we talking about? Are we talking about 10% who are marginally homed? Or are we talking about 1%? I'm not actually sure of the number, but right. I assume it's closer to 1 than to 10.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
And obviously in different parts of the country, it's higher, right? We know that here in the Bay Area, where the weather is temperate, that it's much more likely for someone to stay here as a homeless person or as a less housed person. And we also know that other parts of the country, it's an awful lot easier to sleep indoors if you so desire than it is here in the Bay. So the beneficiaries of an argument that says we should just stop paying rent, in other words, we should disrespect individual ownership of land, the beneficiaries are 90 to 99% of the population, as far as I'm concerned.
Sure.
Who all of a sudden would have much less of a burden in their daily life. But obviously then the first sort of response is like, you know, a lot of people that we know own homes and to some extent are involved in their relationship of being a landowner. You know, they may not be a proper landlord. They might be one of the people who lives in the house. But that is a set of people whose interests we don't absolutely detest, but we often detest. But of course, the real question here is like with any social movement, the people who jump first are going to be the first people to be slapped down. And what would it look like to start a landless movement, or really a movement that rejects property values from the go? What would that look like in the modern context? And in this way, it's not a Marxist movement. Right? This is sort of why I sort of think about it, because like, how is an anarchist able to articulate something that really needs to happen without sort of the burden of the proletariat?
Right. So, I mean, essentially, people would be refusing to pay rent, but basically being like, take it up with my employer, or lack thereof. If you dislike the fact, is that essentially what you're suggesting?
No.
Okay. What help me out then here?
The concept of land ownership is a social arrangement.
But so we're staying in. I'm trying to figure out what you're suggesting.
In our own home.
Right. So wherever we've been renting, essentially, we stay, and then when the person who we've been paying money to every month for the privilege of living in this structure
comes and says, "You must pay the rent."
Right. And we say no.
Rent is abolished.
Rent is abolished. Okay.
I mean, really, ownership is abolished.
And then what? Right. I mean, what is the is there a tipping point at which point they don't have recourse, or is this what?
These are the right questions.
Yeah.
I mean, of course, we don't know the answer because, like, you know, like if you're going to advocate that as I propose a movement.
Right.
Everyone's on board who pays rent. No one's on board who owns.
Right.
Well, okay, that's a pretty nice line in the sand. I know which side of that line I'm on.
Yeah.
So now the next question becomes, like, let's say, now, obviously, if tomorrow everyone did it, it would be an unstoppable force. But, of course, that's not how humans or anything works. Like, so it would have to begin somewhere with some people. And now, of course, we have the problems because the first, you know, X number percentage of people who are gonna say we're done with that false concept.
We'll have a military operation in their neighborhood.
Right. Well, right, and that's if it's as discernible as a neighborhood doing it, then that's one option. But I would suspect that it will look much more like individuals scattered around.
Oh yeah, no, and definitely.
Then it'll just be the cops.
Well, that I mean, I guess what I said, a military operation, I meant in front of their house, a militarized police force.
But this is actually, for me, this is the more worthy conversation in general to have about the cops, because my problem with the cops isn't that they go around arbitrarily beating people. My issue with the cops is that they're the defenders of this particular relationship.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
And so for me, that feels like that would be a crisper way to have an anti-state and anti-cop conversation, because otherwise you sort of look like the equivalent of like lawyers who are chasing ambulances, right? Which a lot of times the left, I think, looks like to most Americans. And so it's one of the reasons that, like, you know, for me, it's terrifying when there's another Black Lives Matter sort of event, because it's like Black people aren't just around and dead. Like, you know, there's a weird cultural disconnect.
Oh, yeah. No, I mean, that's the thing I always say about the whole body cams craze. I'm like, the problem is that police don't just kill people. They also incarcerate them. And the body cams actually help police incarcerate them. Yeah.
I mean, I think that the body cams has already been shown to be a pretty net negative for lovers of liberty, because of not just that, but because of the way in which, like, as soon as you create a system of arbitration and a system of control, really, like, that always benefits the people who are in positions of authority.
Yeah, I mean, you'd think so, but the city I normally live in just had its, like, Black Lives Matter demonstrations moment. And there were liberals crying for body cams immediately, even though the event had been caught on video by a non-body cam. And so the presence or absence of video was not having any pressure on the courts, you know.
I'm not sure if you knew this, but liberals are idiots.
Well, yes. I mean, people who wouldn't consider – people who I would call liberals but who don't wouldn't consider themselves liberals would consider themselves firmly to the left or whatever. Yeah, but yes, I mean, not anarchists probably. Although then you – whenever you see the left do that, then you've got anarchists who line up behind them because it's like the thing, you know. Yeah.
So is there anything you want to say about this blurb in the first place?
I mean, mountains of evidence supporting it, but like it's not – I mean, yeah, it kind of states the thing that, like, every article on millennials has already pointed out, that, like, yeah, we're not loyal to the organizations that we work for because growing up we never saw them as loyal to our parents. I would say even, yeah, I mean, this bit about the janitor becoming the CEO or never becoming the CEO certainly rings true. You know, in food service, you don't even really get promotions or raises. You get experienced enough or get to know the right people to actually just switch to a better restaurant, right? Like, servers all make $2.35 an hour where I live, and it's just a matter of which restaurant you've been around long enough to work at. So your promotion is actually quitting and going somewhere else.
Yeah, I mean, as a tech worker, that's actually true for me too.
Yeah, totally.
Every job that I've taken, I've gotten a pay bump. And oftentimes when people leave a place, it's to go get a pay bump.
Right. Yeah, I started when the restaurant I'd been working at closed and rebranded and opened. The new kitchen manager came in, and I was basically just told, like, on one of the first days, I was like, I'm not a good food runner, but I'm the best food runner, you know, and I work hard enough to stay the best or at least not the worst food runner. And he was like, well, don't you want to, like, show people that you could have a promotion? And I was like, promotion to what?
Yeah.
Like,
food runner plus.
Yeah, there's nowhere to go. You know? Like, I don't want your job. Your job sucks. You're fucking miserable.
Getting the keys is not a good thing in a restaurant.
Yeah, no, I mean, not to get a little off track, but I mean, like, yeah, this whole American dream of, like, owning your own business. Like, I've never worked for an independent business where I was jealous of the owner.
Yeah.
Like, they're always fucking miserable.
Suds is one of the only people in the A-News collective who signs his pieces. So this piece is signed by Suds. And Suds is more or less some version of pro-small business, which is why the ending was framed the way that it was. Is solitary labor of love enough, or do you need something or someone more? In other words, it's sort of like he has a dream of starting a successful business, and what does that look like in the anarchist context?
Interesting.
Thank you very much for this conversation.
Yeah, thank you.
James Squall doesn't have the money to pay his rent. His bills stand tall. I hope he doesn't fall. Susan Q spends up the money faster than it comes to you. Oh, James Squall gets coffee every morning. He doesn't save his money for warning. He doesn't know his rent is due at the end of the month. Oh, James Squall can't pay his rent.
This podcast is the effort of many people. This week, the podcast was sound edited by Leno Mabel. The What's New was written by Jackie and read by Chisel and Dim. The editorial was written by Dim. We thank Aragorn and a friend for their help with the topic of the week. To contact us, get us at podcast@anarchistnews.org. To learn more, anarchist and anti-political books, pamphlets, and other material are available at littleblackheart.com. And for news by and or about anarchists and up-to-the-minute commentary, your friendly neighborhood anarchistnews.org.
It's rent. It's worse than living in a tent. James Squall doesn't have money to pay his rent. A woman at McDonald's paid salary for them and paid their rent 1 month for them. I hope they don't get evicted. I hope the miracle comes through for them. Hope some way they save their money. I don't want to see them be evicted. That wouldn't be funny. James Squall needs a way to pay his rent. He needs a way.